Hello and welcome to another episode of the CG Garage. This is episode number 282, featuring Glenn Derry, one of the world's leading expert, if not in my mind, probably one of the first experts in the term in the field of virtual production. In fact, he is the person that coined the phrase virtual production, which we get to in the podcast. And he came to that conclusion specifically because it was a practical reason to separate himself from regular production. It's really fascinating. Anyway, really have to check it out. Like I said, he is an expert in this area. He worked on in the early days of virtual production and still does. But I mean, he came in from the Avatar days and Aviator and Jungle Book and all of those films. So really, really knows what he's talking about there. But he also comes from the practical side of things. He worked on as a puppeteer AI, which was also a really fascinating story from him as well. I really appreciate Glenn. Glenn's really great in terms of sharing his knowledge and sort of being very humble about his roles in this area. But he's very, very important. So I really appreciate everything that he's given to the field of filmmaking. And obviously we talk about the pandemic and the situation in Hollywood right now with no one filming and how a lot of people think that virtual production is going to save Hollywood. And we talk about the practicalities of what that really means and how that is. So great conversation with Glenn. Really appreciate it. You guys will notice that I'm recording this podcast intro on my own. I don't have my fabulous and wonderful producer, Kristen, helping me. She is on vacation. So that's why I'm trying this video thing outside in my garden, trying to do something different just for kicks. But who knows? Maybe this will work. I was trying something new. We'll see how that goes. But yeah, Kristen is missed. And if you guys miss Kristen, make sure you let her know on social media. Kristen, we missed you on the last podcast. I know, she's great. All right, a couple of announcements. I'm flying solo, so I'm going to try to get through these quickly on my own. As you guys know, V-Ray 5 for Macs is out. And so you guys should totally check it out. It is available. Lots of great new features. So just go to all of this information. Go to chaosgroup.com for more on that. But V-Ray 5 for Macs is out. V-Ray 5 for Maya is in beta right now, so you guys should totally check that out if you want to check out all the new features and how that works in Maya. There are more and several updates to V-Ray 5 that are going to be coming for all our other platforms as we go along. Should note also that if you guys are Phoenix FD users, make sure to download Phoenix FD 4 Update 2, which is critical if you guys are using V-Ray 5. You will need to make sure that you have that update. So check it out. Phoenix FD 4 Update 2 is available too. And V-Ray for Unreal has an update as well that just came out, which is really good. You guys should check that out as well. We have introduced cloud rendering into it because a lot of people have actually been doing a lot of light baking inside of V-Ray for Unreal. So if you're doing light baking inside of Unreal and you don't want to wait for it, you just want to send it off to the cloud, you now have that option. So V-Ray Cloud is now built into V-Ray for Unreal. Definitely worth checking out that stuff. And of course, the other thing I should mention is we have something called V-Ray Collections, which is a new kind of license that we offer, which gives you all the licenses of V-Ray plus all the Phoenix FD licenses. Project Lavina is also included. You get some Chaos Cloud credits and VR Scan all in a single collection. I think there may be one possible exception. I think V-Ray for Katana, one of those is not included, but I don't remember why. But it's pretty much all of the V-Rays with possibly one exception in there. But go check it out. V-Ray Collections, and that is available at chaosgroup.com to check out as well. In terms of the podcast itself, you can always make sure to follow us. Facebook.com/CG Garage Podcast is where you can follow us on social media if you want to follow us on podcast. And you can leave comments. You can even rate us there, by the way. But if you want to go directly to our page, it's chaosgroup.com/CG Garage. And that is where we would be able to get all the information about this stuff, as well as any links. We have a page for every podcast episode out there with any links or anything that are mentioned. You can go check it out there. And if you have, if you want to check us out in video format, we're available on YouTube, and we're available on our Facebook page as well, as I mentioned earlier. And you're welcome to leave comments on that as well, any of those platforms. If you have any ideas or anything you'd like to see in terms of different episodes or new episodes, would love to have them. Love to have those ideas. Just email us, labs@chaosgroup.com, and that's where you can email us at. All right. That being said, please enjoy this amazing podcast with Mr. Glenn Derry.
Welcome to another CG Garage. where the chaos group talks. You'll know it's over when the last bucket drops. We're gonna fire off rays in high dynamic range. We know that ambient occlusion is passe. Global illumination won't lead you astray. And while image-based lighting is really swell, you need to make sure everything has Fresnel.
And you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to clap just to have it synced up. So I'm going to do that. Can you clap in front of your face? Great. Let's do this.
I remember we used to have to do like the whole like, you'd have to take the little cha-cha dance when you're trying to get like the iSync stuff going.
Yep.
When that was the new hotness, you know. Now it's like everything auto syncs. It's so easy.
Yeah, I know. Now it all auto syncs. I still do a little, I like the, you know, just clap for safety, you know. I still like that.
I know. I'm a fan of the clapper, man. I want to walk out with a big board every time.
I have a clapper with the grease board on it so I can go click click.
Excellent.
You know, because now everyone's that's like, oh, yeah, I got a clapper, and they bring their iPad out. I was like, that's not a clapper.
And it's like, that does not count. There is not a, that is the least satisfying clap you could possibly have. I want physical. I want buttons.
Yeah, yeah.
I want clicks.
I want to hear two pieces of wood slapping together.
Exactly.
Well, cool, man. We've been wanting to do this podcast for a while, and obviously a lot has changed in our lives completely, and it's been a little bit of a struggle. But I finally figured out how to record them remotely in a way that I like, because I'm not always a fan of doing the Zoom calls or as a podcast form or as, or the Skypes.
Skype's kind of weird. Like. The audio quality sucks, man. I just in general, every time I see Skype, I'm like, ooh, do I really want to listen to this? And you're like, scrub, nah, I'm done.
Yeah. No.
So, no, this is great.
Yeah, this is really cool. What it does, it actually records all of the audio locally on your computer and then it uploads it. So,
oh, that's sweet.
So that keeps, even if you, even it, huh? It's pretty.
How cool is that, man?
I know, right? So that even if there's like a glitch or the internet connection's kind of wonky, your audio still continues to record locally, which is great. All right, so let's talk a little bit about some stuff going on, because I've been talking about virtual production forever, and you have been in the trenches of virtual production longer.
I hear it's gonna save
Hollywood. It's a big thing right now. It's a big thing right now. But what got you into it? How did this all kind of start, and where did it come from?
Well, you know, it started for me at least before we actually started, you know, doing virtual production, before it was called that.
Mm.
Back in the day, I used to like run around on sets doing like video assistant stuff and like previs, like on location, and kind of run around and do that sort of thing. That was like, I used to do puppets like way back in the day.
But puppets?
After puppets, yeah.
Yeah, like, where were you doing puppets?
Stan Winston.
Oh, you worked for Stan
Winston. I worked for Stan
Winston. Oh, nice.
Yeah, for a long time. That was my like late teens, early 20s was kind of like Stan Winston. Like.
Okay, so you went into like, you know, the cool effects part of things in your early part of your career, right?
Yeah, I was way more physical. My dad's a physical effects guy. I kind of grew up around, blowing cars up and, you know, that kind of stuff. But then it turned in later, you know, I kind of got burnt out doing puppets in like around 2000 and kind of was seeing that, you know, the writing on the wall, like, hey, there isn't a lot going to be a lot of this work left. I was working on a movie called AI and I was puppeteering the little teddy bear, you know. And,
really?
I built this whole cool system to like drive the puppet's face, you know.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Literally, that little thing was like this tall.
He was a pretty amazing puppet.
Had like 56 actuators for a little tiny bear. Yeah. So I built a whole control system to drive them and stuff.
Yeah.
It was driven by MIDI, which was kind of fun. And I would record. I kind of had a setup where I could record his face motion and like hit a button with my foot and actually record. There was a guy named Jack Angel who'd come in and record the audio. The sound guy would like walk over and put the boom mic in his head.
Right.
Or boom mic next to his head, and Spielberg would be standing there, and he'd be like, "Hello, my name is Teddy, and I am a bear."
Right.
And then I would like take the head off the puppet and put it on my station, and like program the animation for the bear doing that, and so I had this like really slick system where it was like foot pedals, and it was kind of like playing a musical instrument.
Right.
And And so anyway, long-winded way to say that I used to do control systems for puppets, and that kind of led me into like learning how to do animation and rigging and all these things, but in a physical way,
Right.
right? Like as opposed to like a virtual version of these things. And this was all at kind of like the heyday of like high dollar visual effects when they were first coming out, and SGI machines used to cost $1 million, you know, back in the day.
Yeah.
As we all, yourself
Yeah.
included, kind of grew up, you know. So but I kind of saw what was happening on set there and said to myself, you know what, CG's coming. I need to figure out something else to do. So I ended up, you know, gracefully exiting Stans. He's a wonderful human being. God rest his soul. And I ended up doing video assist for a while, which was kind of weird. Like I was this guy, like hot shit video assist operator that could like go out on sets and like do compositing. And I had my little Maya set up, and I had like a little baby flame. It was called Combustion. And I'd like sit out on the set, and literally I would do like comps and like temp things for visual effects supervisors and commercials and whatever. And that was kind of my like hardcore introduction into visual effects, was actually being out on a live action
But in
set.
on a set.
On a set, yeah, like so, like comping with like an MX50, like which is like this old school Panasonic mix, you know, video mixer, like you would see on a, you know, like a TV station, you know, back in the day, like an old, you know, public access station, you know, Star Wipes, you know, like that kind of thing. So we had this, you know, we'd have these carts that you'd push around, and they were like a little mini TV station. And we'd take in the standard definition video feeds from, you know, the film cameras back then, and, you know, plug them into your station. And I had like a full on, it was called a D-Vision, which is like a precursor to the Avid or any of those. And we would like just record video, and I'd be cutting the takes and cutting the shots as they were coming off the camera, and kind of, you know, basically trying to figure out how to rapidly get the story told as fast as possible and show these guys back what was going on. This stuff all became commonplace later, but we were doing it, like the team I was working with named Video Hawks, we were doing it like way at the very beginning of sort of digital, you know, video
Interesting,
at the time, which was cool. Yeah, but that's how I came to it, was like from set. Like I was the guy on set who always had the stuff. And but by having all that set experience, as things transitioned into, you know, sort of more like visual effects and CG and that kind of thing, I knew the language that the, you know, like let's say the DP would spoke, because I'd been working with DPs forever, and I knew what directors wanted to see because I'd been working with these guys. So I knew what these guys wanted as tool sets. And so a lot of what it became was just us virtualizing objects that they already knew how to use, right? Because if I'm doing previs, I'm the guy making the shot calls. I'm sitting there, I'm putting the camera up. I'm the one, you know, deciding what the shot is. And that's like the first rule of anything, is you want them to do the work, because if they do the work, then they own it. They put their stink on it, and then it's theirs. So, you know, one of the first things we made was like a little wheels box that would like feed into the motion
Oh
builder at the time. So we would
So what are we
feed
talking
the
like?
pan
Let's give it a like around a time. I know you said that SGIs were like $1 million, which they were, but first of all, SGI was still around, so that already puts it a date on it. But was this got to be what, late 90s, right? Or
Well,
early 2000?
yeah, for me, when we started doing virtual production, that was a little later. That was like 2003,
That's
2004,
still
I would
pretty
say.
late, early.
Yeah. I mean, and then it was simply like, take this, you know, pan tilt head device, this wheels box, and feed it into, in that case, we were using Motion Builder. And what that allowed us to do is I could act like the dolly grip. I was a previs guy. I'd be animating. I'd be doing my thing. And then I would have a guy come sit over my shoulder, and I'd go, you know, and I could give. And in this case, it was like, let's say Rob Legato would come in. We'd be working on Aviator. There was a guy named Oliver Hotz, and I was actually the video guy on Aviator for Rob. But he turned around, he goes, you know how to do animation, right? So Oliver and I would do like the previs. Oliver, you know, we did a shit ton of previs, and then I would take and like track shots and like feed them back into robots, robot cameras, like for motion control and stuff. But the trick was, there was this like wheels box, and you could set Rob down, and Rob could look at the computer and treat it like his own film camera, and we would be the dolly grips. Okay, you want to start here? And then I'd set an endpoint. Okay, you want to end up here? I'd move him, I'd translate him around, and then I'd set an endpoint and hit playback, and then he would glide along that dolly track. And then if he did the wheels himself, now it was like it became a more tactile way for him to get the shot and it feel more natural. So that's kind of where it started for me, where we started coming up with like, what's it like to virtualize these objects, these camera tools for people. That's kind of where it started, and then you know, it went from there.
So would you say, like, that's an actually interesting point, because there's a lot of people that are, and you can, I'm sure, attest to this. A lot of people are using the term virtual production very liberally these days. In the same way, I always joke, it's like, that's like saying, you know, cruise control is autonomous driving, you know.
Look, to me, I mean, virtual production is an awesome word. I was the first virtual production supervisor on Avatar and all this stuff. Really, I'll tell you why we named it that. It was why I called it virtual production, and I made myself the supervisor. It's so I wasn't the visual effects supervisor.
Oh, right.
It's like there's another creative guy there who's doing stuff, but I, you know, it's like I'm doing things similar to what they're doing, but I'm sort of focusing on the production side, the front end side, as opposed to the back end side. Right. And so it was a good way to delineate the work. The team that I was working with, building, hiring, you know, shuffling around, we're doing different things than what you would do in a post work.
Right.
Right. You know, we're building sets. We're not working on shots.
Yeah.
Right. It's a different concept. Right. So,
because the minute I really sort of define when I classify something as virtual production is specifically just what you were describing before, is when you gave the power of the camera back to the filmmakers in some way.
Yeah. And honestly, you know, the very beginnings of it were just simply self-preservation. It had nothing to do with me like wanting to do it. It was like me saying, hey, I need this guy to buy off on my shots. He's not doing it. But if I give him the camera, he'll buy off.
Right.
On the
here,
shots.
You do it.
You do it. Yeah, exactly. But there's all these awesome side effects with that, which is like, look, you're bringing people who actually know what they're doing, and they're great at blocking shots, and they have the techniques, and they know how to light. Yeah. And you're giving all that stuff back to them. And as much as I love, you know, back-end visual effects guys and CG, and I love it, and I live in that headspace.
Right.
There's something about taste that comes into play, and it's really hard to teach taste.
Yeah.
It's really easy for me to go in and say, like, build this asset, do this thing, but when I say, like, put it all together and make a shot out of it, it's wildly different depending on who you're dealing with. But if you're talking to, like, you know, Bob Richardson, every single frame is going to be a masterpiece, right? And Roger Deakins, or something. Like, you want those guys to do what they do. So let's just, but this happens to be the tool we're using right now. So let them do their job. You know.
So I've always had this analogy that, you know, right now, as you know, there's a lot of people that are sort of, especially people that don't know much about visual effects. They basically are being saying it's all CGI, so it's not looking good, right? And there's a lot of filmmakers who are like, I don't like CGI. I like it to be practical. You know, they've been using that term a lot. And I think it's misguided. I think that, you know, a lot of people think that CG makes things look bad or blah, 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 whatever it is. But really what I believe it is, and I think this is, you know, basically what you're saying is, when before filmmakers, they would do something. And then they would be going into this black box of a visual effects company, and they'd wait like 6-9 months to wait for something to come out the other end. And they don't know. They have no control over what it is. And it's like really hard for them to make any decisions. When you basically give them back that power through, you know, giving them the camera or, as you know, more and more developed along the line, which we can get to. But when you give them back that power, then suddenly the CG becomes just another camera, and they feel that can be part of the film process again, right?
Absolutely. I mean, like when 3/4 of your movie is a visual effect, right? If you look at any modern Marvel movie or something like that, where there's no set, there's nothing there half the time, except maybe like two actors and a green screen. It's like, it's really hard to make a decision that ultimately, you know, after it goes to this giant machine with thousands of people touching it, the more handmade you can make it, the more towards the front end you can help those decisions get pushed along. You know, it just makes a better product. It just makes things look a lot better. And you're right. You're right on the money. I mean, the thing is, the second you kick it over the fence, if I have no idea what's going to come at me, and many times, you know, sitting in a director or DP's shoes, you don't even know how to articulate what's wrong.
Right.
You're like, you're sitting there going like, I don't even have that language. Right. Because you know, the visual effects supervisor at that point's all beat up and just like, fuck, I just want to get this thing out the door. I mean,
I'll do those six tweaks and I'll show it to you next week. I mean, that's like, you know,
there's that part of it. And just simply like, what are the six tweaks I want?
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's such a hard thing. Like, it's so hard where filmmaking is, at least that I've participated in, is a hugely collaborative experience. Yes. You're out there and you're seeing it.
And it's about live iterations as well. Yeah,
it's exactly. And the faster you can make those iterations, that's what, and I've heard your podcast. I mean, you preach this stuff all the time. So it's no news to you, but yeah, when we were first doing it, when we're out building these things to enable these guys to do it, it was like really groundbreaking crap at the time, because you're like, literally I'm going like, hey, here's the previs, here's the shot, here's your camera, go.
Right.
Now they're like, okay, now they're in it, now they're actually making the movie with you, versus like, okay, let's go do another review, you know, like that whole process of even in previs, which is the fastest version of storyboards, if you way back, but like previs, even though previs is really fast, it's still like six dudes in a room, you know, banging out on shots, and you're only seeing them once every 3 or 4 days, right?
At best, right?
Just because it takes time. This is more the way I like to, you know, and the systems I built and the people I put together, I like to work at the speed of a live action set. I want to be a guy who calls something out on a radio and it just shows up and the director is able to react with it. Like, that's the goal, right?
Right.
Because that's what they're like on a set. If I say, oh, I need to bring a tree over here, you know, the greens guy goes, tree comes in, and you know, like, we're just doing that all, you know, live with fancy computer tools now. But it's the same concept. Once you've got director attention, once you've got everybody, production designer, everybody kind of getting behind it, it really does make for a better interactive experience and a better product ultimately.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's really cool. Okay, so your last, we talked to you on Avatar. Actually, you know, interesting. One of my classmates from architecture school, she was an art director on Avatar.
Oh, cool.
I don't know if you interacted with the art department that much, but then.
All the time. I mean, they were in the building with me. I was there.
Christy Wilson was her name. I don't know if you know her.
Christy. Yeah.
So she and I, she would always talk about stuff, because she came from, like, you know, she's just doing practical art direction and I'm coming from CG side of stuff. And so when she's involved in like Aviator, she was like, there's all this CG stuff. And then she's like getting frustrated. It's like, no, it's really cool. And so I'm trying to explain to her all of that stuff, you know? So,
honestly, that's most of the world I live in now is front end. It's that
right.
Interaction between the, you know, production designer, art department,
yep.
And then that has to get turned into something
yep.
that you're gonna go start making the movie with, right?
Exactly.
And in the old days, it was right. It's like illustrators and, you know, set designers go and they start drawing and hand out plans to construction guys, and you know, off they go, nails go into boards, you know.
Yep.
Now it's the same thing, but it's like you know, that those designs go off to a group of CG modelers who are, you know, either they're starting on the back end like, you know, Weta or like some, you know, big visual effects company going for it, but what the world I live in is, let's build a video game version of that. Let's make a really fast slap together but looks halfway decent version.
Right.
Of those designs, so that we can start putting a place to things, right? I
want
to build an environment. I want to know that I'm in a place. Like, you're a big proponent of ArcViz and architecture. It's the same thing. I want the place first, and then we'll go tell the story within the place, right?
Yeah.
Which is that concept. You know, it's kind of fundamental to us as humans, right? I mean, we need to know kind of where we are and what we're looking at. Movies, to a degree, you know, ultimately you end up with just this 2D thing. That that's the end game,
right?
And animation is very interesting because it's usually like a storyboard, and then that storyboard just gets like refined, right? It just keeps like turning to better versions of those storyboards.
Yep. Starts right? with a napkin sketch, and
that's
evolves
right.
And then all the way.
So this is similar, except that you get to play in the physical space before you go. You get to play in the 3D space before you go out to the physical space,
right?
To begin actually, like, you know, nails on boards, and the way we're using the tools now, and I say the tools in a generalistic sense, like Unreal Engine, you know, virtual production things now,
right?
And we can get into that in a bit, but the idea is you're using this tool set to help build the movie before you go build the movie, right?
Right.
So and when you're doing that, you're involving everybody, the director, the, you know, the production designer, everybody, DP, in the best case scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And you're getting everybody on the same page early. And it's just a very, I don't know, it's collaboration to the nth degree if you're doing it right. That's what I love about it.
Well, it's really cool. Obviously I've been following along for a while. I mean, the ideas that are going in there, as well as the tools and the revolutions of the tools, because the tools have changed drastically. You know, when I first started sort of exploring at Chaos Group, started exploring virtual production, and what we were looking at was, obviously, for Construct, we were looking at doing real-time ray tracing, et cetera, et cetera. And I was in Motion Builder. I saw the limitations that tool had, but it was really a cool tool at the same time, but then it just sort of became very stagnant. But I could see, like, you know, one of the biggest problems is that it gave you a kind of an idea of what it was going to look like. It was just a grayscale. You could get a little nice, but it wasn't really going to be very nice, right? So the limitations of what it could look like became sort of a thing, which is, to us, was a thing like, oh, well, here's an opportunity for us to ray trace, right? And to see something really cool. And it was a kind of an interesting thing, but obviously now the entire industry has shifted from, you know, obviously using Motion Builder to using game engines as their interface in a lot of ways. And it seems to me that that's an interesting idea, because the whole premise of these game engines is literally to build a game. And what you are literally doing is building a game for the director to play. Director.
Yeah, I mean that's I mean, you know, like I love what, like, Ben and the guys did on Lion King.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was literally like make a movie the video game, right? I mean, like, that's
yep.
Which is really cool.
Some very expensive joysticks, but yeah, it's good.
Very expensive joysticks. Yeah, exactly. And that was kind of like that's kind of like the next level, right? Like when I first started, it was literally just, well, when I was first building the things that everybody was using.
And you were physically building it. You do a lot of building things.
Yeah, yeah.
Just so people know, like, you build the camera sets that go on people's heads. You build things, like, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that was electrical engineering. So I had myself and a team, you know, my brother and Alex. And
yeah. Gary,
like the guy, I have a team of guys that we had for years and years built the hardware that people were using. So when people say, like, the virtual camera that was used on it, like, we literally built the camera.
You right.
Know, put the monitor on, built the joysticks, wrote the interface. Did all, you know, all the stuff that it took to actually make it function. And then the facial capture is the same thing. We actually, you know, took the cameras, gutted them, you know, redid the circuit boards, redid the optics on them, you know, ball mounts, baboons, all that stuff's manufactured, the carbon fiber helmets, all of it. You know, we literally manufacture all that.
That's
so I had a
amazing.
Small company that did that. So
yeah
it's called
Technoprops, that was, right?
Technoprops, yeah, yep. yeah. So and then through all of that, you know, that was, I guess that's kind of what made what I was doing a little unique, was that I wasn't just a guy who would go, you know, it'd be neat if we could, I would actually go, yeah, you know, it'd be neat. And then I'd go, like, build it. Right.
Build it.
Like
yep.
there's a very, like, instead of waiting for people to figure out how to do it or what it was going to call, I just make the stuff. Right. And we had the technical and the machine tooling and all the stuff that it took to actually do that. So
yeah.
It kind of gave me a little bit of a, I don't know if competitive advantage is the word, but it allowed me to do things it was really hard to do if you're working for, like, a big visual effects company or something like that. Like, just getting the budget approved for something like
that.
Did you know Andy Lesniak?
Did you know
no,
Andy?
Who's that?
Andy, well, unfortunately, Andy passed away, but he was one of those guys that he would say, like, I've got an idea, and then he'd disappear in his garage, and then he'd, like, come back and, like, build something. It was like, whoa, what? And then
look at that, dude. I love
and it was so cool, you know, because that's a lot of stuff. I mean, you can have an idea and you can sit at your computer and build something in Maya, whatever, but then, like, come back and, like, here's a physical thing, you know? And the maker idea of being on set is kind of an amazing thing. Now, obviously, 3D printing has become a lot easier, and everything is sort of, and it's there's a lot of stuff that you can, like, construct on top of this, because the game engine stuff is pretty powerful, but it's also very open ended, right? I mean, there's a lot of things.
I mean, the game engine is a whole other world of stuff, because you, like, it's not just the visualization of, let's say, your inputs into the thing, right?
Right.
You can also do things like have, you know, AI-driven characters and character control. And you have to learn this whole other level of both on the programming side, like how to actually manipulate these things and build them up. But also, you know, the rigging is a little different. Like the whole thing is slightly different because you're looking for real-time interaction with it.
Right.
And the way the materials work and like all of it is just, it's just like, and there's so much to it. That's the big thing. It's like, it's not just, you know, like those of us who've like, oh, I'm a fucking master at Maya. I'm great.
Yeah.
It's like, no, dude, you know nothing when you get into Unreal.
Yeah.
And I've watched it again and again because I'll hire guys and just like, they go, whoa. But I mean, the cool thing is, you know, Unreal's been awesome. I say Unreal, I mean, Unity's great too, but Unreal has been amazing. The support has just been outrageous. Like Kim Liberi and the guys, they're just in it to win it, man. They're really putting resources towards
That's awesome.
Specifically our industry, which is
right.
unheard of. You know, I mean, like
I also think it's good that there's actually two great companies like Unity and Unreal, because honestly, the only tool you had before was Motion Builder, and then it was good luck, right? And that's fine, but it became stagnant, and it's like you get what you get, and you don't get upset, right? And so right. That's what I told my kids when they were little. It's true. So then it's like, okay, so now you have Unity and Unreal, and they're both trying to up their game every time, like, and so now suddenly sure. like, oh, we're as a user, you just get take advantage of it, right?
Yeah, and the cool thing is you're leveraging a lot of, you know, in the same way back in the day, you know, we would leverage like the, you know, the physical effects industry would leverage like the aerospace industry.
Yep.
The reason California is like the best place in the world to do movies is because there's all these ancillary businesses around that can support
yes.
the visions of the filmmakers.
You've
got great construction, you've got great aerospace,
mm-hmm.
you like all this work that came out of there, and that enabled like the physical effects guys to do it back in the day. Well, the game industry is supporting us now in that same way, in that a lot of these tools are being put into place to make better looking, you know, faster rendering, more awesome video games, and we get like the benefit of that as storytellers. We get to just take those little bits and pieces and go, oh, well, that thing renders in real time now. We can do that. You know, it's just
right.
It's so much better, you know, and you know, being able to leverage that consumer support is what makes Hollywood work, right? Hollywood's like pirates and thieves, man. I mean, we just want to do things as cheap and fast and fake as possible. Like that's just how it works, right?
Right.
If I can build a facade, I'm not going to build a real building, right? It's like just right. goes back to the fundamentals, right?
Yes.
So the fact that we can lean on these, you know, awesome game companies to put out, you know, amazing fast renders. It makes them, it's so cool. And it really, it allows us creatively to make decisions a lot sooner in the process than we could before. You know, like the way I put it now is like, what's changing is like, let's say you want to do one of the LED wall kind of gags, right? I want to throw mm-hmm. something up on, I want to do Mandalorian stage, right?
Right.
Well, you have to start thinking of your production a lot like we did back in the 80s and 90s. You have to like design the sets and build the miniature that you're going to throw up.
Yeah.
So that you have something to have on the wall, right? Like
yeah.
the wall is like the display mechanism, but there's all this work that has to go ahead of it in order to get it so that it displays on the wall. And that's the part that, you know, everybody looks at the big price tag on the wall itself and goes like, oh my God, that's neat. But really the work, the actual, and I mean, creative and technical work is actually on the front end to deliver the assets that can then ultimately go up on the wall.
Right. But also you save a whole bunch of money on the back end.
You do. You do. You certainly do.
So, and you don't have to have weird costs.
You have to fly
because everyone looks
green. That's the thing now.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing now, right? In-camera comps are awesome.
Right.
But even if it's not an in-camera comp, you still need to have something to put onto the green screen, right?
Yeah.
Like that.
Yep. Absolutely. So it's, I think it's very interesting that whole process, and we can get more into that. But so there are several things, obviously, you know, you were there when basically they were starting to look at cameras and virtualizing cameras in some way, either in the previous phase or in the actual motion capture phase. Obviously, I'm assuming that you were probably involved at some point with the Avatar camera system, right, as well, that they were using on the way back in the day.
Yeah, the physical, the Vince Pace one?
Or yeah.
The, yeah, like, I mean, we interfaced with it. So
okay.
We took, so Vince and Jim had built out the 3D, the physical 3D cameras, the Pace camera. And,
right.
I don't remember what it was called back then, but the Fusion system is what they called it. They had been working with that for several years on Jim's, you know, National Geographic projects, some 3D work that he had done at the time. So Avatar was kind of like the first kickoff of a major feature. You know, we're gonna, I think Eric Brevik had done some stuff with Journey to the Center of the Earth using that camera system. But we were, so he had kind of prototyped a bunch of stuff. But ultimately, we had to figure out ways to interface with that camera. Because, like, if we're going to do, I don't know if you guys know what simulcam is. I call it simulcam. Yep. It's you know, real-time CG overlaid augmented reality style with the cinematography camera. So we've got, so what we did is we took like Motion Builder and basically wanted to meld Motion Builder with the Vince Pace camera system that was coming. Uh-huh. But you have to know things like what's the zoom value on the lens,
yep.
things like that. Like, so we had to write,
encoders or to go through.
In that case, Patrick, who, had designed the camera, they had this, I called it CamNet. It was like a very specific protocol. And we would decode the CamNet and then turn that into values that we fed into Motion Builder to give us the lens information. And then we built these like active marker systems that ultimately got used on like Jungle Book and a bunch of movies after that.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we would take like motion capture cameras and put them around the set and then capture this little marker cloud that was on the Cameron Pace rig, mm-hmm. and then that would give us like a rigid body of where the camera is, and then we would, you know, put a virtual lens where that real lens was,
right.
And then, you know, basically run it through that same, remember I was talking about the old little crappy video mixer,
yep.
same concept, called a 4A in this case,
yeah.
HD, but like Avatar, you have to remember that was like the first time like HD was out really.
Oh, that's right.
Like that was the other thing too. So there's all these things happening at the same time. We were doing 3D. We were doing, you know, all the mocap stuff real time out into Motion Builder, you know, real time. We were prototyping the first, HD Avids that existed.
Wow.
We had all the first like HD monitors on the set that weren't like, you know, these giant behemoth, you know, like the flat LCD ones, the Panasonics that everybody used.
Yeah.
So there was a lot of like first, you know, cause we were all just coming off of standard def, but that like Avatar was like a defining moment in the sand from a production side,
right.
where all these things were changing. And, you know, it was cool cause we got to play with all the latest, greatest toys. And I had a company that was, both Technoprops, it was providing like the helmets, and we were building all, you know, the VCAM and the actual camera that Jim used,
right.
and all this stuff on the virtual side. But I also was in charge of all like the video assist and the routing on the stage and, you know, building out editorial and putting together the storage systems and all that stuff was all kind of all, we had this little hangar, which I think is now the Google, YouTube.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
And okay, so that building was where we did Avatar.
Yeah,
like that. That was all.
Got
so,
it.
But it was like it was before all the fancy glass walls.
Oh, yeah.
And nice Google came in. It was a real poop hole back
yep.
then. It was.
yeah, I well
but that was
Google does a good job of cleaning things up because they're in the
yes,
in the old digital did. Domain building, and that was not a very.
I was
yeah.
the big whale,
yeah.
the big whale. The
yep.
digital. So Avatar is a funny one because I actually remember doing a meeting on Avatar in 1996.
Yeah. It was in production for a long
like
time.
Like DD.
Yeah.
yeah. Well, Jim had written that script
yep.
in Titanic,
mm-hmm.
right? And he pulled everybody into the whale because he owned yeah. DD, right?
I've got an idea. I'm going to do Pocahontas in space.
exactly. Something like that. And we were going to do puppets.
Oh, really?
Like Stan Winston. Yeah, I was there as part of Stan Winston's
oh,
crew.
That's right.
Like standing in the big whale. Yeah, I had like t-shirts of like Avatar, you know, Digital Domain, Stan Winston, Jim Cameron.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like crazy.
Wow.
So reading that script then 10 years later
yep.
when I got brought in to sit in the thing and I was like, oh, I remember this. You know?
Yeah.
Like,
well, I just did, I did a recording with, what's his name? Ben Proctor. And Ben's been working on the Avatar
That's
sequels
awesome.
For over 7 years.
There's a whole group of people who never left.
Yeah.
Like a lot of the guys.
They've been working on it since the 90s.
Yeah. Well, they're the DD guys. But like the crew we put together, we started putting together in like 2006, late 2005, early 2006.
Yeah.
There are key technical crew members, you know, Dan Neufeld and Ryan Champion, all these guys,
yeah.
they've been there, you know, Jeff Burdick, they've just been there the whole time.
Yeah.
They've never left.
Wow.
It's like a career, man.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It's not a movie. It's a career.
It is. Well, I felt like it. I was on it for 5 years.
5 years. Yeah. That's a long time. That's a long time.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Which is still cool. It's still cool. And I mean, obviously, you know, the thing about Avatar that I think is interesting is that, honestly, you know, between you and I, the movie I think was was fun. You know, I don't find it a groundbreaking movie in terms of a movie, but I think it was incredible in terms of the achievements that it did. I think it really sort of made people realize the importance of filmmaking in terms of trying to get things to look a certain way and to push technology in such an incredible positive way. So there was so much innovation that came out of Avatar that is trickled out to the entire world, right?
It became the prototype for how, you know, a lot of media is created, not just movies, but like video games, everything else that kind of, like, if you think about like how game cinematics are produced
right
now, you know, they're leveraging all the stuff we did, you know, on Avatar. It's pretty cool, actually, because we provide like the helmets and the V cams and stuff to a lot of these guys. So as techno props, I don't own it anymore, but when we were doing that, yeah, we became like, you know, this little niche industry of doing, you know, facial performance capture for everybody.
Right.
It was really cool, you know, and it wasn't just, actually, it was kind of weird because there was this lull in the film production side. You know, you do Avatar and then, you know, you go in and you have a meeting and the very first word out of the producer's mouth is, well, we don't have Avatar money.
Right, yeah.
and I'm like, well, we didn't either when we were making Avatar. We just kind of made it
right
up as we went along. But, you know, everybody thinks it's like way too expensive. So there was this low. We did like a few movies.
It's interesting.
You know, right on the tail of Avatar. We did Avatar. And then, you know, Spielberg did Tintin with Peter Jackson.
Yeah.
We did that one. And then we did Real Steel. And that was it. And then for a while, it was like nothing.
I love
like
Real Steel. I worked on that movie.
The best on-set experience I've had in my
life. I've heard that too. I've heard the same thing. And honestly, the thing that was so weird to me is that I was on Tron and then I went on Real Steel to hold me over for a while. So they put me on Real Steel as a lighter, right? Just because I just didn't have anything else going on. It's like, oh, we'll put you on Real Steel as a lighter. It's like, great, I can light robots finally. And then I looked at the script. I'm like, you know, and then I like watched, I saw some of the art. I'm like, and then I started working with it. And I was like, this is really good. This is really good. And I saw the movie and I was like, this is a really good movie. Like, it was a lot of fun. It's
great. I love that. I love the movie, man. Sean, the director.
Sean was so cool. Eric Nash was great.
I worked with him again recently on Call of the Wild. So yeah, no, I love E. Nash, man. He's a great, great guy. Love him a lot.
Yeah, it was such a good movie. And I loved how rigorous the information came through. So a lot of the lighting that came through and the robots were really cool, both the practical and the CG ones. And the fact is there was a lot of shots where there was a practical robot and followed by a CG one in the next shot. And they both looked great and you couldn't tell which one was which.
DD did a phenomenal job. I mean, the Legacy guys,
yeah.
You know,
the Legacy guys,
again, Stan Winston's crew, right? Those Stan are my boys. Crew, yeah. I grew up there. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, no, the great physical builds. And like you said, man, it was like that movie was just dialed in terms of like the information flow. And like, you know, we would go out and when we were doing the mocap, we would actually survey the set using, you know, we would have, what's his head? Jesse.
Jesse Chisholm. He's been on the podcast.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so he would survey the set, give us the information, and Swen, you know. We would actually take their surveys and use that to calibrate the mocap volume.
Right.
So like where the robots were at in space was accurate to the actual set that was you know, LiDAR'd and everything. It was like, it was all one cohesive world space,
yes.
Which never happens, right?
No.
It's always like ever. I mean, it was the only show that since I've done it several times, but that was kind of the prototype for me of like, oh, this is what it's like to take this, you know, kind of, you know, science experiment and pull it out in the real world.
Yeah.
You know?
You're absolutely right. And for my side, it was exactly the same thing because I would be basically, I would get the same data that Sven and Jesse had. And, you know, it'd be like in the arena, for example, right?
Yeah.
And then, here's your shot and here's the camera and then here's the robot that's animated. And I would basically say, okay, so first thing I do is I import all of the set data from, that includes all the lights. They had all the lights built in. And I was like, okay, so now I hit render and it looks perfect. So what am I supposed to do?
What am I doing as a lighter? Yeah. Well, and that's where PBR was just kicking off as well.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
like
yeah.
All that sort of the ray tracing, that was all like, right at that moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, was coming into being at that time. So yeah, no, that was amazing.
So it looks great. I mean, I can imagine now you'd like it's this is to the point where we, like, this could be real time. It really just there's no.
Well, that's the next gag, right? Because I want to be able to just throw a little probe out on the set and go and then feed it in. And here that lighting probe is now feeding my Unreal, you know, Sky Dome,
right?
And that's what's ultimately lighting the CG effect that I'm putting into the camera in real time. I mean, that's all stuff that, you know, we played with. It's done. I think NCAM does it. You know, they've got a setup for it. We've built a similar one. It's cool. It's cool stuff, man. I mean, that's certainly the future.
And that's certainly what I was trying to do when I was doing Construct. I started realizing, you know, obviously if I take what I do and now if we can render things fast enough because of the advances in software and hardware, if I can render things fast enough, and ray trace them, and that's another thing that's becoming very important, then you're bridging that gap, right? You can take the stuff that's going in and basically the filmmaker can get a much closer look at what they're supposed to look like and make those adjustments right there, you know, because how many times have I been given a plate of a blank background and say, put a robot in there or whatever, you know? You know,
yeah,
they never lit it for a robot.
You got no set photography. And you nothing. Don't know what they're looking at.
No contact. Yeah, but if they actually had like a CG thing that they would say, okay, now compose it the way you want it and actually have a virtual robot in there and then the DP could actually light it correctly, then it would actually be a much better thing.
No, it's cool. It's certainly coming along. And watching, I mean, I don't know, did you see the new the tech demo that they put out last week? The Real Guys?
Yeah.
So many triangles.
Yeah. So I actually have an analysis of that. So here's the thing that I always try to look at is like, okay, so real time is, obviously what we do in the film industry has to look very photoreal. It has a lot of complexity, et cetera, which you can do because most of the rendering is offline. So you can just throw a whole bunch of stuff at it and it's fine. You can render it offline. You're not worried about the real time stuff. It's slow as hell, et cetera, but that's okay. But obviously that rendering is getting faster, but at the same time, the hardware and software on the real time world is catching up. So it's catching up along the history part of things, right? So the way I put it is the way that I looked at that Unreal 5 demo, it's like, okay, what they accomplished is they accomplished a huge amount of triangles because what they did is basically micropolygon stuff that was what RenderMan was doing back in the day, right?
Sure.
Before they went to full ray tracing. So they do micropolygon. Right. They're not ray tracing. They're doing micropolygon rendering, which is a really cool. Basically, it's rays,
From point of camera.
And so every pixel is a polygon, which is a really smart way of doing things. The fact that they're able to do that in real time is kind of incredible, but also really cool. And then the other thing they're doing is they're doing all the GI through basically what RenderMan was doing back in the day through something called brick maps, right? So they're doing the brick map GI, which is, again, not ray tracing, but still really cool and really effective and not 100% physically accurate, but very believable and does a lot of really cool stuff. And it's really great. So the area that they've landed in the film history of quality of work is WALL-E. They got to WALL-E.
Yeah. Which, right? By the way, WALL-E in real time is pretty badass.
Pretty badass. And and in fact, if you look at WALL-E, especially the beginning, was kind of a tech demo for brick maps and micropolygon because those giant trash heaps, it's kind of like the giant canyon that we saw in that demo. So it is kind of an amazing thing that they've gotten to that point now. And obviously, I think what it's ultimately going to go is real time wants to get to ray tracing, fully ray traced.
They do, and the hardware will get there, right? I mean,
the hardware and the software. The software has to get there too, and so there's a lot of challenges. Ray tracing is slow for a reason, right? So it's because it's very complicated things that you need to do, but you will get there eventually,
right? And so the systems I've been like, you know, brainstorming in my head, and I actually talked to you with years about it, is like, what's the fastest way to get something that I can punt out to a proper ray tracer, bake that lighting in for the scene that I'm working on, and then bring it back into my game engine, you know, on a lower poly asset as fast as possible. What's the process right. to make that turnaround go as quickly as possible? Which is a lot of stuff they're doing on Mandalorian, frankly. I mean, that's how they're able to achieve that sort of, you know, depth of look and the sort of GI that they're doing is they baked the lighting.
Don't tell anyone. Yes, they baked the lighting. Yeah. It's not real time. Yeah, no, of course not. Of course not.
But like for me, you know, if I'm out on set, if I have like just a giant, you know, AWS cloud somewhere that I can hit a button and get that thing back yep. in 3 minutes back to my set, I'm fine with it. I don't care. And I'm willing to throw gobs of money to make that happen
right.
if I need to, right? You know, like that's the thing that the film industry has that's kind of interesting, and we can do some things that maybe game guys can't do, right? Like
right.
we could leverage like just big gnarly whatever it takes.
Well, think about it this way, right? So think about it this way. If like so in order to be real time, you have to render at like one frame has to be rendered in 1/24th of a second, right? It's a lot. Now, if you basically say, hey, it doesn't have to be real time, but I can check it out in just a few minutes and say I'll render one frame a second, that's going to give you 24 times more quality out of it. Right.
Exactly.
So you can be like, I'll wait a few minutes and then I can see what I just shot. Like I'll see it in real time for this. And then I'll wait a few minutes and see it a bit higher quality. You know, so like my circle take was like, great.
Yeah.
Throw that one on the farm and I'll see it in a bit. You
that
know?
Was the same concept we would do with motion. It wasn't just renders, right? It was like we do the same thing with like the motion capture that we're working with. So we'll capture a take. Right. Yeah. And I'll just have like a rough, you know, whatever came off the volume, you know, version of it that we'll go and cut. And then once they select the cut, okay, that's my cut. Great. Then we put it over and go ahead and clean that particular take up, fix the fingers, do the faces, do all that, but only on the sections we need to. Right. So it's the same thing. It's like this like concept of an offline online. It kind of carries through. Right. Like I've always considered the when you're doing like a full virtual production, real time virtual, you know, like Tintin style or Avatar, you know, in Pandora style, you know, this offline, I need something off the stage really quick to be able to make a decision to know that my scene is blocking well, that the animation is working, that the actor's performances are good. I need reference of all that. I need that put in a way that's easy for me to manipulate. I need a camera on it so I can, you know, get some idea about what I'm, you know, what sections I want. Now go cut those bits out that you actually want, give those back to me. And then those are the parts we're working on, because we can't work on every frame of it's too much data.
Sure.
You know, it's just too much work for everybody to do. So, but the same thing with the renders, right? If I go out and I scout in VR and I kind of go like, okay, that's this area. We're going to be looking that direction. Good. Kick it over the fence, run it through V-Ray, do whatever you need to do to make that area, because we're going to be looking that way, look great. And then bring it back in and we'll put it onto our lower res geometry that'll actually render on the screen, you know, on the screen as we go. So yeah, no, it's the same concepts. And that being able to get those decisions, you know, the delivery out of those, that front end virtual production is the decision of what you're going to do. Right. Like it's not the actual assets themselves many times. It's just like, what are we doing? Are we building this? Are we physically building it? Are we virtually building it? What are we doing? So we need enough information at that point to make those decisions.
What do you think the reaction of filmmakers is on this stuff? I mean, basically, I mean, have you seen a shift? It's like, oh, this is so much better because of this or that. I mean, what is the general reaction that you're seeing from people?
Well, right now, given the Rona and all the stuff that's going on, it's like, this is the only way we're going to be able to make movies. What do we do? You know, like I'm not going to be able to go to London and shoot in the streets anymore. How do you do? You know, like it's very like practically driven. Right.
Right.
But you know, for me, look, man, I think if you can engage your creative participants as early as possible, if you can engage them in a way that's meaningful to them, then you got them. If it becomes a technical exercise, if it becomes a, you know, like you and I geeking about renders, you know, like that you're going to lose a lot of people, right?
Yeah, but that's us.
But that's us and your audience, right?
Right.
But like when I'm in the room and I'm trying to get these guys to buy off on something, it's like, here, you hold the camera. I was always, or here, you get in the suit, or here's your actor, talk to him. And he'll give you, you know, he'll act right now and you're going to see it. And that immediacy gets everything flowing and it gets decisions to be made, and you're not doing reviews. And you're like, if I can abolish reviews forevermore, I will have won. That's my goal, is to make it so there are no more like 6 hours sitting in the room with laser pointers. Cause it's not as, I mean, you need that when you're doing finals and shit like, but I mean like in the process of just trying to figure out what the movie is, it's just a, killer in terms of creativity. So yeah, the faster you can turn that stuff around, that you have the engagement, you've got director involvement. Like I treat pre-production like production, right?
Sure.
So I like, hey, you're on my set for 5 hours today. We're going to be doing this, right, this. And since I'm the guy who a lot of times is sort of ADing it as well, and like putting the schedules together and figuring out how to get all these guys to work together, like that process of engagement is how you keep these guys motivated and in it. And, you know, and then there's the machine that it takes to, you know, get through the number of shots and, you know, the stuff that has to be built and all these things. But like the more you have them early on, the better they are. And you were asking like how every director I have ever dealt with has fallen in love. Now there are exceptions. You know, Oliver Stone, not his favorite thing in the world, right? He's okay to look at this stuff and go like, not for me. Right. But most of the guys that, you know, I've worked with, you know, some, you know, big names, but also, and I'm not saying he's not a big name, but like Wes Ball, great guy, yeah, you know, that, yeah, that's kind of like the new school, right? Like he's, yep, much more
hands-on. And he's very CG oriented. He knows CG
that's
really
right.
well. Yeah.
So that's a very different experience than working with like, you know, a Bob Richardson or a,
right,
a you know, it's just a different thing. Like those guys, you know, you're trying to emulate the old way. With the new guys, you're trying to say like, oh, you play video games? Great. Here's a video game controller. I'm just, right, trying to get the information out of you, man, as fast as,
right,
possible. Yeah, so, yeah, you know, I when people say like virtual production, I'm like, it's just production. We're just using different tools. It's the same thing. And with that though, you know, we do have to train kind of the new people coming up. Like my goal is to take like dudes who are used to working on mouse and keyboard and, you know, get them some puffy jackets and put them on set. Like that's my goal. Right. and you have to learn kind of like how things work out there. You know, there's a history to things, and that's a lot, sure, of what a lot of the fun I have is taking guys who've never been on a set or, you know, and say like, all right, here's how it works. You know, you're going to do this. And, you know, the first time I put them in front of the director, it's you, buddy, go have fun.
Right.
You know, it's like, that's empowering for an artist who's, you know, been locked in a back room for the last, you know, however many years working on stuff.
Sure.
Like, it's really cool to see them, and they either sink or swim, you know, it's on them, but it's really fun to watch that process.
Now, obviously, you know, I mean, you're kind of a guy who figures out how to get things done and builds it if it doesn't exist, right? So that's the, yeah, thing that's kind of cool about what it is. But do you think, I mean, obviously now there's an interest, obviously, in virtual production. There was an interest before coronavirus, but obviously coronavirus has made it much more interesting to people because it's the only way they're going to get their movies done in some cases. But is there... I mean, do you feel that there's going to be some new tools that are going to be, because right now, if you're looking at virtual production, it's like it's the Wild West. It's like there's so much going on.
So I'm gonna talk about what I want to happen.
Please tell me.
what I want to happen is, and this is gonna be heresy. I'll probably get flamed for this, but I want to see a union come out of this.
A union.
Here's why. Hollywood is built on a bunch of very small, you know, small individual freelance entrepreneurs.
Yes.
Who go out and own a little bit of their little company. They're the video assist guy. He owns his video assist cart. And he's getting rental on that.
Oh, right.
So there's an incentive for him to do awesome work. If I'm, you know, backup fourth string at third floor, love third floor, great mm-hmm. people. But if I'm there... You don't have the same incentive and mindset working at a visual effects company as you do when it's your ass on the line on a movie set.
Right.
And so the people who will rise going purely freelance and not working at ILM and not working at Weta and not working, that's what productions want, are people that are working on their show. They don't want to have to hire the stuff out. They just don't, but it's the only way they've been able to get the work done today.
Right.
And so if there were a union, and the reason I say union is you guys still want bennies. People who are doing visual effects still need benefits. They still need, you know, healthcare. They still yep. need all these things. And so if I'm locked into working at MPC because that's how I'm able to afford my benefits and stuff like that, it's maybe not getting me the best people possible out on set.
Right.
So if we made an actual union where there was like an equivalency of you to the camera department, the virtual production supervisor's DP, you know, the right. the VAD guy's like a concept artist. therapist, right? Right. So there are already equivalencies out there. It would, the IA could come in and like set this up so that there were like ways for these guys to get benefits. And then the crews would go from show to show to show and do what they were doing. And then they would also be entrepreneurially incentivized because they could have their own kit and do all these things. Because right now there's like this, like you said, it's the Wild West. Okay, I need a virtual camera. Who the fuck do I call?
Right.
Is that even me? Right. Yeah. Like I have it. I built the stuff. I can rent it out and do all this stuff, but I'm, you know, like you as an individual, if I were to say, like, if I go to a DIT and I say, hey, I need a monitor, he goes out next day, buys it, and he's renting it to you. Right. I want to give that same power to the individual operators who are, and operators and supervisors who are out on the set. They need that power because then they're because the hours suck.
Right.
And the food is okay, but it's not the same thing as, you know, going down the street in Culver City, right? Like there's a lot of things that make working on movie sets hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an easy lifestyle choice.
Right.
It's fun. It's creative. It's awesome. But so what do you need to do? You need to entrepreneurially incentivize these people to want to get out of their cushy post jobs.
Right.
And the only way to do that is to, you know, there's got to be some upside to it.
Right.
And the small company owners who are trying to put this stuff together, they're in the situation where they can't afford to pay insurance on their guys and everything else because it's just, you know, not financially viable for them to do so. But if you sort of, like I said, if you came, so I'm an outlier in that case because I see how it works in the rest of the industry.
Okay.
And I don't think of virtual production as visual effects. It's not, it's production.
Right.
So you need to have that production mindset. You need to have that production.
And the thing I think is also interesting, and you know, I may get slapped for saying this too, is I think that's interesting is that visual effects and specifically previous companies are all like saying, we do virtual production. It seems like they're trying to shoehorn some new technology into their old legacy systems. And I feel that visual effects right now does have a huge amount of legacy that they're not letting go of. And that's not necessarily how to make movies and how to innovate.
Fundamentally, the studios over the years have made it insanely difficult on visual effects companies. The margins are too low to innovate.
Yes.
Straight up. That's why when you look at like Unreal, they've got the cash flow coming out of Fortnite in order to afford to innovate and help everybody else out.
Right.
And guys like me, once in a blue moon, get a movie every 10 years that we get to innovate on because we've got a crazy person at the helm who's able to get things promoted and get the studio's vision behind and alter their scripts if they need to make it work for the technology that's there, right? You know, Favreau and Cameron and these guys. And you know, I'm one of the blessed few, right? In that regard, I'm fully aware of that. I'm not special in any regard in that way. I just happen to be really lucky and got to work with some really cool people who didn't care how it was done. And I could say, hey, we'll get it done. But like the industry at large, it is really hard to scrape a living as a company. If you're doing visual effects, you built a pipeline. The reason you have this fixed, rigid pipeline is because it allows you to get, you know, 1,000 shots out a week if you need to at the end of these things, right?
Right.
And if you don't have all that machinery in place, you can't do it. But that rigid pipeline keeps you from doing fun shit on the front end of the set.
Yeah.
Because you know what I'm saying? So it's difficult. That's why I'm a big proponent of like individual entrepreneurs doing their thing because I think that's how it will actually get done. And I think that, you know, like I said, the Unreals of the world and companies like that, you know, they're able to put out products that we can all, you know, kind of grab onto and go, oh, we can build a whole little, you know, niche out of that.
Right.
And make it work. Yeah.
Well, this is really cool. We're getting close to an hour. So this has been pretty amazing. But what's going on with you right now? Can you tell us what you're doing to right now, obviously?
Yeah, I mean, I had a company, Technoprops,
you know,
little 10 seconds of backstory, sold it to Fox in 2017.
Okay.
We built the Fox VFX lab, which was like, you know, director Wonderland. I basically built, I'll go ahead and say it, the coolest motion capture virtual production stage on the planet.
Okay.
Built it. It was awesome. It was great. Unfortunately, when Disney took over, there wasn't a place in the Disney empire for it.
Right.
So just the way their business is structured, we couldn't really find a fiscal place to like chunk that group of people under. So I had to disband it end of last year. So right now I'm kind of chilling. I'm doing some consulting on the side. I'm hanging out. So this has been I basically my contract was up in January. So I've been kind of hanging since then. And I'm working with I'm working with Agbo right now, just doing some script breakdowns.
Well, the thing is, you have a huge amount of knowledge right now, and the fact that you're sort of a free agent is probably a good thing for a lot of people in the industry.
Look, man, I love building teams.
Yeah,
that's my favorite thing in the world to do. Yep. I love getting good people and putting them together and coming up with really cool stuff. And you know, as I'll do the little plug here, I'm starting to build teams again. So you know, if I'm giving you guys calls, you know, pick up the phone. It's happening.
That's great. Well, I'm really excited. Obviously, as you know, virtual production has been a big interest of mine ever since I dabbled in some of the weird stuff on labs when I was working on construct stuff. But obviously, I mean, I've been thinking about it forever, but like, and when I started, things like this is going to change. Something about the movie process is going to change. And it was really cool to see that. Obviously I saw what you did on Jungle Book, and I saw, you know, some of the things that were going on Lion King. And I was like, this is just going to get better and better and better and better and better. And I'm very excited about what filmmaking is going to mean to people. So it's going to be really cool. And I actually even think, you know, you're talking about ArcViz and architecture. I even think that the technology that we're doing, like, is going to not just be for filmmaking. This is going to be like, that is the new AR in a sense of things, right? Of looking at things and exploring things. And architects would be able to use these tools to explore their spaces in the same way. So
ultimately, I want to build a world and I want to tell a story within it. Whether that story is, hey, this is an awesome place to be, which is ArcViz, right?
Right.
And you want to be here and we want to build this. Or
right.
If that story is, you know, 2D narrative that's, you know, sort of traditional, or if that story is more 3D interactive. I mean, ultimately, that's the thing, right? And the idea of persistent worlds that we can pop into and tell stories within and get out. If we can make, you know, the tools work so that it's easy to do that, it's just better for everybody.
Yeah.
And you'll see more and more of it. And, you know, I look, my kid, you know, he's got his little system over here. He's playing in Unreal every day. He's, you know, it's really cool to see awesome. How far this stuff is coming along.
Yeah.
For just anybody, man, like Blender's free, Unreal's free.
Yep.
Like there's no reason not to just do it, right?
Yep.
You know, Substance does not cost very much. You know what I'm saying? Like
no.
you can make really good looking stuff. I mean, Quixel's free, you know,
it's right.
like, this is an insane time for computer graphics and for people who just want to, you know, tell stories or, you know,
build worlds.
Stories, I build worlds, man. It's,
yeah.
It's an unbelievable time. So.
Absolutely. Well, cool, Glenn. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Pleasure, man.